was born and bred in Messina, of all places, many moons ago, and went to university and caught a love of my life. And we went off to Rhodes University, where we spent it. He did his PhD there, and my son was born there. And one day, I was sitting at work in a library in Grahamstown, and I got his call, and he said, "I found our place," and that was in Hoedspruit. So I had to catch a midnight flight from PE to Joburg, and then wait for his parents, and then we came and we looked and we found this wonderful place. We took a couple of years, I think 3 years, until he was done with his studies before we moved here. But it was such a wonderful experience. And I started then off to work with the Rural Foundation, who was working with farm workers in the irrigation district. And from there, I done a stint at the Southern African Wildlife College. And that is where my love for conservation also grew. And then we started off the Kruger to Canyons Biosphere. Now, the reasons for that is another story. But first, let me give you the opportunity to Nick to introduce himself.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks, MT. I grew up in Joburg, and from a very early age knew that I didn't want to live in the city, and also had opportunities to visit the bush as a child. Like, I think most people's love for the bush starts when you're a kid, and I just ended up studying game ranch management, and my first real opportunity or job was working for a ground hornbill project, which is also in the Hoedspruit area still to this day.
Yes, we interviewed them a few days ago.
Yeah, so I, in the early days, was part of that based on Mabula, and spent a lot of time in the Lowveld. Did a stint with BirdLife South Africa in KZN in the Eastern Cape, and then this opportunity arose to come through to Hoedspruit. And me and my wife... always wanted to move back to the Lowveld. We love the mountains of KZN, but the bush has a really important spot in our heart. So that brought me back, and I've been with the Biosphere now for about 6 years.
Okay, you've both settled here now. This is definitely what you say, your roots are planted for both of you. But you never know in this life, but for now this is your season, and that's what's wonderful. And from the starting of Biosphere, so from what I've picked up from 2011, is that when it started?
Actually, we got our recognition from UNESCO in 2001. Okay. So the company, the non-profit company, NPC, was started in 2011.
Oh, I
see. But for the first 10 years, we run projects as a voluntary organization. So I've been with the Biosphere since 2001. For those who can do maths,
yep.
That is. Maybe it's important to tell our listeners a little bit about what is this designation from UNESCO. Yes. So UNESCO gives this designations to Biosphere reserves or biosphere regions. We prefer the term region because that includes people and protected areas where there is a demonstrated value of biodiversity conservation and sustainable development. So for me, it's about that interface and how biodiversity can contribute to the livelihoods of the custodians of the land. So a biosphere region normally got a core area, which is our protected areas, of course, and then a buffer zone around it, and then the transition zones where we farm, work, play, and do our shopping and live. And in our case, we actually are a cluster biosphere. We are having a core area and the catchment areas, which Nix is going to talk about extensively, because that's a big passion. In the mountains is our catchment areas, and then, of course, the Greater Kruger region. So these two core areas and the ecosystem services they provide to the whole of the landscape is then included. So a biosphere designation is a long process that you write in all your documents and then you are reviewed. So we are very fortunate. We've done our second 10-year review, periodic review. We're flying colors, which was a big boost for not just us, because we are also reporting on what other people do in this landscape, you know, in this interface of biodiversity conservation and sustainable development.
So when you get that recognition and it's approved, and there's obviously criteria that you've all got to follow to have this approved again, what is the advantage to that? Is it what that accolade comes with what?
It comes with responsibility, you know.
But you get more funds that come available to you so that you can continue with your projects.
Yes, that's true. And the recognition that's embedded in this, but you also are part of a world network of biosphere.
Wonderful.
So we, as the KTC's, got a partnership for biospheres in Germany and also in Peru, you know, so that's very interesting. And there's learning exchanges happening between it. In South Africa, we actually do have 10 biospheres. And can I quickly name them
with
for
pleasure.
You?
With pleasure.
So to the north of us is the Vembe biosphere. Yeah. And then to a little bit more to the west or north, southwest better, the Waterberg biosphere. Yeah. Then we also have the Magaliesberg biosphere and the Groot Marico biosphere, also for its cultural relevance. In the Cape, we have the West Coast biosphere, we have the Cape Winelands biosphere and the Kuchelberg, who was accidentally the first biosphere in South Africa. And then we have the Gauritz biosphere, and then the last one is the Garden Route biosphere. So it's all spots in South Africa where there is dedicated conservation efforts, but also the ability to demonstrate how conservation can work with people for their development.
That's amazing. That's fantastic. And it's wonderful to hear that it's so spread so across our country and that it's not just the central point is just here. So that makes for amazing. So that must have a big team involved that's actually part of all of these other biospheres. And
exactly.
They've got their own people, their own cultures, their own guidelines of what they're doing, their own criteria of what they've got to look for in those areas, and that obviously gets all fed into one head office per se. Is that correct?
That sits within the Department of Environmental Affairs or Department of Forestry, Fishery and the Environment, DFFFE. Where we all report, and we do have then a national committee for in the country which endorse decisions and interact then into the world network of biospheres.
So that's so good to know that decisions that get made for certain areas have to go through that type of criteria, that it's not just going to be wreck and ruined just because someone thinks I can put a building up here or I can do something up here. It's got to go through all of that, which just makes it even more of a reason than ever to have these organizations in place. And from your side, Nick, how do you break down what your section is and what you cover?
So, I mean, like MT said, biospheres have this focus on people, but then there's also a focus on conservation and nature. So all of our projects very much try and address both. And the biosphere stretches from the Kruger National Park in the east all the way up to the escarpment areas. So if you think of Graskop and Pilgrim's Rest up to Hainesburg, those areas. And the idea is really that it's, you know, looking at a landscape and how do we which makes it difficult. You know, conservation projects quite often, you know, focus on a species or focus on a very small area. And we're trying to take a whole landscape into account, which, and there's interesting trends, I think, globally that conservation efforts are shifting in that direction. You need to conserve landscapes. And if you think of Kruger and everybody, we get our water from the mountain. It doesn't matter if you're, you know, an elephant drinking water on the Olifants River or you're a farmer in Hoedspruit. You know, everyone relies on the mountain, and everything is interlinked. So we have undergone quite a serious prioritization process, trying to identify those interfaces. Where are the areas with the highest biodiversity, the areas with the most important ecosystems that we rely on, as well as the people, people that are also the most vulnerable and at risk, and you know, so and what often what usually happens is catchments come out and corridors that link to Kruger. We exceptionally lucky in this region that we've got Kruger and a lot of protected areas that are protected, but the escarpment areas are generally underrepresented. So we focus a lot of our work on securing those catchment areas and securing and protecting corridors, but it's also about working with people and different partners to achieve that. And so that's sort of the broad look, and there's a lot of detailed work underneath that, from alien invasive plant clearing to working with private landowners to declare their land. We work with communities. We also work with private sector farmers in the Hoedspruit area, to other initiatives working within communities, spreading awareness about waste, trying to deal, and MT can talk a lot to that. You know, we've got major issues with waste in communities because of the lack of municipal services.
Yeah, of course.
And again, because the system's interconnected. Mm. A nappy in Bushbuck Ridge could end up in the Sabi Sand somewhere or something like that. So our projects try to address all of that at multiple levels. So taking a landscape view, but also having very focused projects on the ground that try and address those issues.
And I think when you're looking after conservation and human beings, you know, it's there's a fine line between that, because you sometimes there's more more energy being put into wildlife than there is into communities and human beings per se, and obviously to not create that resentment and fight and anger between that, you've got to run that as smoothly as possible, or as side by side as possible. Because I mean, I know that a large part of poaching is mainly for food, for sustenance. In a lot of these areas, and if you can then obviously try and educate them, the communities, that there are other means and ways to live off the land, and would that be something that you'd partake in, and training and nurturing those communities?
Yes. So very interestingly, and I think Vusi will come and talk to you at some point, we are using a safe system methodology, because the other side of it is that elephants come and raid crops, or lions come and catch cattle. So there's a safe system methodology where it's about safe wildlife, but safe people and safe assets. And the community go through a whole process to identify what they can do. And I do believe, and Vusi will tell the listeners more about it, that we do have some success in, for instance, two communities adjacent to one another, the Palobeni community, which is just north of Palabora. We worked with them. And before the work started, the previous year, 23 elephant was killed by leaded because they were raiding crops. And then the next year after the workshop, because people was aware, they understood the education efforts and took ownership, none were killed. Oh, while the next door community had the same here, when there was zero in Palobeni, Maubola had actually 13 killed, but we recently also did a workshop there. So it's about ownership as well, that people feel part of the conservation picture and what can be done to mitigate these efforts.
100%. And with regards to sustainability, also providing these communities with self-help tools, like you say, encouraging them to sustain themselves, crops, making products to sell forward. And are they as integrated in this? Do they live on those lands?
That's part of the engagement and the empowerment that's happening with those structures as well. So it's not plain sailing, and it is a difficult thing, but there's ways to deal with it. A very interesting project that we done in terms of carbon credits, and now we're starting to move on the financial sort of domains. But we distributed between Indicator C, but also in parts of Vembe, in partnership with the Vembe Biosphere, which is to the north and also adjacent to Kruger, 450,000 efficient cook stoves to households. And it's a constant monitoring. But out of the sales of the carbon savings, because these stoves use only twigs, and we calculated, and with science-based information, you know, how many trees are actually saved from being cut down
and burned. Yes.
So, you know, because they only use twigs, etc., from the stoves, but there's difference than what I would have used and what are you actually using now, and it's very much monitored and audited by external auditors. The sales of the carbon credits enable also other projects to apply for either tourism projects or other sustainability projects. Mm-hmm. So we are very fortunate, you know, Angie, that you will also talk to. She's doing the community income generation models, and she will be able to talk to you about how this funding enable sort of then SMEs and businesses to get off the ground. Instantly, one of the ones that she's looking at right now is in this Palobeni community, where they will be planting chilies and okra. And chilies, of course, is a detergent for elephants. So if you rather plant chilies than cabbage, you know, then that is where the whole adaptation process is coming into play.
I didn't realize that elephants don't like chili. So I shall have, luckily I don't have to plant a chili plant outside my house. But that was a very nice fact. And Nick, from your side, are you more in the conservation side of this biosphere?
I manage the catchments and corridors portfolio.
And do you handle any of the poaching side of things?
Vusi does that, okay. So I think that side of things Vusi will present on. My work mostly centers around the catchments areas where we're setting up teams. We've got a major challenge in the catchment with, there's various challenges in the Blader and other catchments, but there's alien plants that are slowly but surely taking over the landscape in the upper Blader and other areas, and that has a direct impact on our water sources. So there's efforts to clear those, and it's very challenging and difficult landscapes. It's anyone that's been on top will know.
How do they get there? Does it come from cattle being treed or from animals? Does it come from monkeys that are eating and dropping things, or is it humans?
It's usually, the escarpment areas, you know, have a history, initially mining, and later on timber species, eucalyptus and pines were planted for timber, mostly to feed the mines, and then later on people obviously learned and realized that it was also quite lucrative in terms of the forestry sector. So it's basically, and forestry has a, you know, rightful place, and it's an important economic driver, but then you have issues with with escapees. And then, you know, those escapees move into grassland areas and can take over natural habitats. And that has a huge impact on water resources and negatively impacts on biodiversity as well.
I'm sure.
But then the people element comes in because, you know, although it's got an impact on biodiversity, there's also an opportunity to create jobs. And that's part of what we're trying to do.
And that job creation is also what grounds the communities. It keeps them more motivated to follow the rules and the regulations and try and keep the environment as livable as possible. Are any of those lands on any land grab areas, or are they on land that is owned to previous generations?
A lot of the land in the Upper Bladers areas that are claimed by communities. So there's been a big national process with communities that have claimed protected areas across South Africa. But the agreement is that if they'll claim them, but they'll always be managed as protected areas.
Okay.
But then the thing is, you know, and the hope and the goal is that those communities should benefit from that protected area.
Okay.
So the communities we work with in the Upper Blader have actually made decisions to increase the size of the reserve. So over the last 5 years or so, we've worked with the Blader communities that have actually set aside an additional 20,000 hectares as part of Blader River Canyon Nature Reserve. So the reserve, because of the efforts through the communities and MTPA, Provincial Conservation, various non-profit companies, has doubled the reserve as well. But it's one thing having it, you know, those areas declared. It also means now you have to try and manage them as protected areas.
Of course.
And a lot of those areas are faced threats like alien plants, poaching, you know, a whole range of different threats.
And how far up is it, for example, Cape Vulture Lodge out that way? The Cape Vulture Lodge on the Drakensberg Mountains there. Does that fall under your catchment as well?
It does, and we've actually been working with the private landowners of Manutsa, that Cape Vulture colony. So that farm has now been declared as a nature reserve.
Okay.
So we helped facilitate that process working with the landowners. And then that escarpment piece borders on a community that we work with over the mountain. If you go over the mountain onto the other side, and then that community borders onto Blader River Canyon Nature Reserve.
Okay.
So again, you know, all these systems are connected.
Yes, definitely.
And you've got private landowners adjacent to community-owned land, adjacent to provincial conservation land. And obviously the idea is trying to manage and protect those areas with various different landowners and politics and things in between.
I'm sure, and I'm sure there can be some controversy there. You know, if you've got some people that don't understand what the bigger picture is, and then you've got private landowners that have paid millions of rands for their property. So I can understand that there will be disputes, but as long as it gets resolved amicably, that's what it's all about.
And I think, in our experience, it's intrinsically, people have the same wish for land.
The same goal.
That they want to protect these areas and look after them. So there's a lot more in common than what we all think.
And they're not in common. And going forward, Martina Tinker?
I think it would be interesting for the listeners, is Nick just quickly give an overview of how protected areas are declared, you know, and how do we secure, because it's done under the national legislation and provincial. Do you want to tell them a little bit about the instruments, what is available for communities?
So there's specific criteria that has to be on that land to qualify it as...
Yeah, no. So I mean, we're a biosphere, but we don't have any specific legal standing, if you want to put it like that. So we work with existing legislation to achieve our objectives. And South Africa has got an incredible biodiversity stewardship protected area expansion program with several organizations involved across the country. And South Africa's got targets to achieve protected area expansion. It's now packaged as 30 by 30 targets. So in the year 2030, the goal is to have 30% of South Africa's land surface declared and managed as protected areas. And that's impossible for government to do on its own. So it relies on communities and private landowners. And through the Protected Areas Act, there's mechanisms for private landowners to declare their land. So when I say private, it's private, communal, corporates, whatever it might be. Any landowner can declare their piece of land as a nature reserve or protected environment based on certain criteria. So you can't just decide to declare anything. It has to have conservation value. But it's a really important mechanism, and there's been huge achievements in this landscape. Over 100,000 hectares have been declared over the past sort of 8 years or so. A lot of it has been paid, funded by international funders. But the interesting thing is there's also a major shift with lots of private landowners wanting to go through that process and actually willing and able to pay for that. So we also offer it as a service.
Can you sell your land?
Yes.
Can I sell my land and say, yeah, you can take it and use it to be a part of the...
So it's an individual landowner's choice, obviously, if they want to declare their land or not. And there's various reasons why landowners would want to do it, whether you're community-owned land or private land. But then it comes with a formal declaration, which comes with certain restrictions. If you sell it, it gets sold as a nature reserve. In many cases... and with the open system of Kruger, there's been a lot of work done. You know, Kruger is declared. It's a national park, and then you've got your APNRs and those areas that are open to Kruger. And historically, portions of those were declared. Portions of that land also wasn't declared, so there's also been a big push to declare land that's part of the open Kruger system. So we have been involved in those projects, and it makes sense. If you want to be part of the Kruger system, you know, your land should probably be declared a nature reserve. So landowners do it for various reasons. There's also incentives linked to it. Because landowners are making commitments that's helping governments achieve their 30 by 30 targets, there are tax incentives in the Murrelling landscape. There are rates, rebates linked to those commitments from landowners. But those incentives are meant to encourage. It's really about willing landowners that want to make commitments to conservation, and generally, like a lot of landowners want to do it to leave some sort of a legacy that their property that they've grown up on and have loved and looked after is declared and passes on to their children as a nature reserve, and so yeah.
Yeah, who wouldn't want that, hey, to have that legacy for your children? I think it would be wonderful. And going forward, obviously there's projects constantly coming up. What is something that you can say you've just started now, or is there something that you are focusing on at the moment going forward?
We always start new things.
always new things happening?
Always. That's maybe
I think what is very interesting is also how a good tool Indigenous knowledge can be for conservation. We actually spent the last 2 days at Wits Rural Facility with Professor Wayne Twine about his honor students coming out in July. By the way, I think, you know, we are quite a hot spot. We always think about tourism as only the, you know, the safari tourism or the, but there's also quite a big element of what I call academic tourism. Mm-hmm. You know, other universities or students from the cities come and spend some time. Voluntourism is, of course, another big element that helps us in this region thrive. But just back to the rural facility, so the ethnobotany group is coming out in July, and we will link them up with a group of our students, our colleagues that we call Indigenous Knowledge Custodians. And they done a survey with older community people about what is their understanding of climate change? Is there any value on science in nature that they predict? So it's for us very interesting to make this link between the different generations, the young people talking to the older people, and now this knowledge that they gain, they're going to share it with some city students in an embedded experience. And just to say how the Biosphere Connection is doing, linking up, so the same type of process or case study will be happening in a Canadian biosphere, but also our neighbors Vembe Biosphere, and all of us will learn how this whole education can work. That is just one example of something new. Other important thing, and I think Nick alluded to it, is about the waste. You know, the waste. We've got the one at London. All of Hoedspruit's waste is going to the London landfill site. So we have some waste pickers that we partnered there with, selling on the recyclables. But we're doing now a big baseline study with University of Western Cape in Bushbuck Ridge to see what. So it is a baseline study, understanding the waste patterns, where the waste is coming, how the waste flows, what is the lack of waste services meaning, but also what is the possibilities, what can be done
with it,
what value adding can be done to make it a cleaner environment. We've worked also quite a bit on what we call AHP, absorbent hygiene products, with the nappies, because now I'm going to floor you with staggering figures. In Bushbuck Ridge, there are 276,000 nappies being used every day.
Yeah.
With no waste management services. And then in Maruleng, in the Hoedspruit area, it's 36,000 nappies every day. So we studied a bit on what do the moms do, why are they walking, because most of these nappies are actually being dumped in streams or in dongas. That links to the problem of sand mining that has happened. And this is all upstream from our protected areas. So a big flood comes around, then, all that plastic is going down the rivers into the protected area system, but eventually it lands in Mozambique and in the Indian Ocean. So we have trialed some solutions, and I know we are a long way from really implementing solutions, but starting with awareness raising, trying communities to use reusable nappies that you have to wash, the modern cloth nappies, and in another community, incinerator,
where you can just toss it in.
There's still a long way up. And by the way, people in Hoedspruit also dump their nappies in that truck that's coming to London landfill site.
To come and drop everything off there.
And they mix it with the other. What Hoedspruit people can do to help those waste pickers is with clean, that it's not so dirty. If the nappies can just be separate to the other waste, that we don't mix it in, it will already be helpful.
Where would you classify a nappy? Under which waste label?
That is an unrecyclable. There's nothing you can use of it at a moment, But Kimberly Clark is also working with us, and we need to find solutions for the future. But at the moment, if people can just separate it, because the communities do separate nappies from other waste, they don't mix it like people in Hoedspruit does. But we've done a very interesting project with Kimberly Clark funding to see how large waste, wet waste, food waste and nappies perhaps can be combined to make products, compost and things. But at the moment, the results of the work is still a little bit inconclusive. We need to work, but through that we had quite a big understanding that we did it specifically with Sabi Sand Nature Reserve, and the communities on the boundary of Sabi Sands, Huntington, Lilydale, Justicia, and they then, you know, there is possibilities if we work with the especially with the early childhood development centers or the creches in the community, that they can be spots where this can be collected.
Yeah,
and if it can be combined with waste from wet waste from the lodges into making compost, which can be then used in a food garden. So these are small ideas that needs to grow and that we need to all work on together.
I think there's so much to be done, and constantly, you know, there's a saying, and how do you eat an elephant? A little piece at a time. Because, oh, not that was the right. but that's what it boils down to. You cannot, it's impossible for you to try and tackle everything at once. So you've got to break it down, and you've got to take where each one comes from, and what you can do to make those changes in each and every different channel. Mm-hmm. And but that's just this is just a small part of what you guys actually cover. Mm-hmm. And this is why we want to start this, where we do a weekly interview, so we can start focusing on a little bit more than just the holistic reason of what you are about, and just delve a little bit deeper into different projects that are running at the moment. And but just today alone, I think it was just a really great overview for people to understand what you do, where the name comes from, and in total, if you could put together a number of how many of you are employed that actually run the section here.
So done payroll last week.
Okay, so you should remember.
Yeah, but you know, that also include 36 people from Vembe Biosphere, but we've got on the payroll 70 people, but that includes the 36 of Vembe Biosphere. Yeah.
Well, that's a strong team, hey?
Yeah.
And every team member has a role, and that's how you move forward as smoothly as possible.
And there's also to mention, there's also people that aren't on the payroll, because we have contractors as well that do alien clearing. So then they employ additional people. So if you count
that
them,
is the model, yeah.
It's an additional 100 people or so.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's a big.
So it's almost 200 people.
Yeah, it's a big crowd. It's fantastic. It's phenomenal. Well, Angie, is there anything you'd like to add on to this? We're going to do another interview. I think we want to break it up into 5 interviews.
Yeah, I think it's 5 to start.
Yes, 5 to start, definitely. So who's going to be back in studio next week?
Romy.
Okay, fantastic, fantastic. Was there anything else that you guys would like to add?
No, it's just lovely to chat.
Yes,
nice to chat.
Such a privilege. Thank you for having
us. It's an absolute pleasure. And just to everyone out there, and what makes our beautiful town even more special is that we know each other, we can communicate with each other, but let's keep our town clean and let's just be on the lookout for everything possible. You know, it doesn't matter, we don't have to go and be a part of a big dehorning of a rhino that makes you now part of conservation. There's so many other little things that you can do to put your 5 cents in that makes you part of the conservation of our area and where we are. So big or small, just remember conservation, love local, and that's what it's all about. So thank you guys for coming in studio, and this podcast is going to be recorded. We're going to eventually record all of them, and we'll put them out on